All right, so we're diving into Mark chapter 9 today, and this section is really just packed with these really fascinating stories and teachings. We've got the Transfiguration, we've got a really intense story about a boy with a demon, and some really important lessons on discipleship from Jesus. And to help us unpack all of this, we have Dr. Mark Jennings' lecture.
Yeah, this is one of those sections of Mark that I think really gets to the heart of who Jesus is and what it means to follow him.
Totally. And Dr. Jennings really emphasizes that we can't just look at these events in isolation. You know, like he says, we have to see how Mark has been building up to this point. Like, it's all about context. So what stands out to you in how Mark kind of sets the stage for this section?
Well, if you think about it, like, Mark has already shown us so much, like Jesus's authority over nature, over disease, even over evil spirits. And then we get to the Transfiguration and it's like everything just ramps up. And it's this incredible moment where Jesus's true identity really shines through.
Okay, so let's actually dive into the Transfiguration itself. Dr. Jennings paints this really vivid picture. You know, Jesus takes Peter, James, and John up a high mountain, and suddenly his appearance is just transformed. Like, his clothes become dazzlingly white, like brighter than anything you could imagine.
And then to make things even more dramatic, Moses and Elijah appear with Jesus.
I mean, talk about an unexpected guest list, right?
Yeah.
It really makes you wonder what must have been going through the disciples' minds at that moment.
Yeah.
But why those two figures specifically? Like, what's the significance of Moses and Elijah?
That's where it gets really interesting. Dr. Jennings argues that we can't just see them as representing the law and the prophets, you know, like a Sunday school lesson come to life. Their presence points to something much bigger, the eschatological significance of Jesus's ministry.
Okay, so for anyone listening who might not be super familiar with that term, can you kind of break down what eschatological means in this context?
Sure. Eschatology refers to the study of last things, you know, the end of the world judgment, the ultimate fulfillment of God's plan. And in Jewish thought, Moses and Elijah were both deeply connected to these ideas. I mean, think about it. Moses received the law on Mount Sinai. Elijah ascended to heaven in a whirlwind. So their appearance with Jesus at the Transfiguration would have been like this incredibly powerful sign for anyone familiar with those stories.
It's like they're signaling that something huge is happening. Something that connects to those ancient promises about God's ultimate plan.
Exactly.
And then, of course, we have Peter's reaction, which is, well, interesting to say the least. He suggests building three tents, one for Jesus, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. Mm. What do you think is going through Peter's mind when he says that?
Yeah, he's clearly trying to, like, make sense of this really extraordinary experience, but he's still missing the point a little bit. Dr. Jennings suggests that Peter might be trying to connect this moment to the Jewish Feast of Tabernacles.
Oh, wait.
It was a festival that celebrated God's faithfulness and provision throughout history, but it also had these strong end times overtones, you know, connecting to this idea of God dwelling with his people. So by proposing three tents, Peter's kind of trying to contain this incredible moment within a familiar framework, maybe even elevate the status of Moses and Elijah a little bit.
But he misses the mark a bit, right?
He does. He's still not fully grasping that Jesus isn't simply on par with Moses and Elijah. Jesus is the central figure, the one who fulfills and surpasses everything they represent.
And then, as if to drive that point home, we get that voice booming from the cloud.
Yes, the voice declares, "This is my beloved son, listen to him." It's a powerful echo of Jesus's baptism where a similar declaration was made.
Like, God is saying, look, I know this is a lot to take in, but pay attention. This is my son and you need to listen to him. He's the one I've sent.
Exactly. And Dr. Jennings highlights that this declaration actually echoes Deuteronomy 18.14, where Moses prophesies about a prophet like himself who the people must obey. So this voice from heaven is explicitly identifying Jesus as that prophet.
So we've got this incredibly mystical, almost otherworldly experience on the mountaintop, this incredible affirmation of who Jesus is. And then, bam, we're back onto earth. Jesus, the disciples, and this crowd gathered around a boy who's possessed by a demon. What a shift in scene.
It is a jarring shift, isn't it? And you have to wonder what it would have felt like for the disciples to go from this, like, incredible spiritual high to this really difficult, messy situation. You know, it highlights the fact that even after witnessing Jesus's divine power, they still face these very real, very human challenges of ministry. They try to cast out the demon, but they can't.
And Jesus is clearly not happy about it. He rebukes the crowd, calling them a faithless generation. I mean, ouch, what's the significance of that phrase, and why do you think he uses it here?
That phrase, faithless generation, appears throughout the Gospels, and it carries a lot of weight. Dr. Jennings connects it back to the Israelites' doubt and rebellion in the wilderness. It's this recurring theme in the Bible, God's people struggling to trust and obey him, even after witnessing his power and faithfulness. And in this case, you have to wonder if their lack of faith is also connected to the disciples' failure. It's like their doubt is contagious.
That makes sense. If even Jesus' chosen disciples couldn't cast out the demon, it's easy to see how the crowd might start to question things. And then we get this incredibly poignant interaction between Jesus and the boy's father.
Yeah.
The father says, if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. What do you make of that, if you can?
Yeah, that if you can is crucial. It reveals the father's doubt, which has likely been fueled by the disciples' failure. He's essentially saying, look, I've seen your followers fail. I've heard you call us a faithless generation. Can you even do this? And it makes Jesus' response all the more powerful.
Richard.
All things are possible for one who believes.
Man, that line gives me chills every time. It's such a powerful statement about the potential of faith. And then the father's reply is one of the most honest, vulnerable expressions of faith I've ever read. I believe, help my unbelief. What do you think it is about that statement that resonates so deeply with people?
I think it's the honesty. You know, he's acknowledging his own weakness, his own struggle to believe, and he's asking Jesus to meet him in that place. It's something so many of us can relate to, right? We want to believe, but sometimes doubt creeps in. It's a reminder that faith isn't about having it all figured out or never experiencing doubt. It's about acknowledging our limitations and humbly seeking God's help to strengthen our faith.
It's a powerful reminder that we're not alone in our struggles. So Jesus casts out the demon, and then later when they're alone, the disciples ask him, why couldn't we do it? What's his answer?
This kind can be driven out by nothing but prayer.
What's Dr. Jennings' take on that statement? Is he saying it's literally impossible to cast out a demon without prayer, or is there something more to it?
I think Dr. Jennings makes an important distinction here. It's not about having the right magic words or formula. It's about the posture of prayer. It's about recognizing our dependence on God, aligning ourselves with his will, and seeking his power to accomplish what we can't do on our own.
So it's not just about saying the right words. It's about truly surrendering to God's will.
Yeah.
And relying on his strength, not our own.
Exactly. And it's a theme we see throughout Mark, this tension between the disciples' human limitations and the power of God working through them. And it leads us right into the next episode in Mark 9, which might seem like a bit of a head scratcher at first after this encounter with the demon-possessed boy, Jesus, and the disciples are back on the road. And it doesn't take long for another teaching moment to arise, this time sparked by, of all things, a disagreement among the disciples.
Yes, the disciples getting into a little bit of a squabble. It's almost comical, right? You'd think after witnessing the transfiguration and all that followed, they'd be a bit more, shall we say, enlightened.
You'd think so, wouldn't you? But that's the beauty of the Gospels. They're so honest about the very human struggles of these people who follow Jesus. You know, they're still learning, still growing, still making mistakes. And sometimes those mistakes involved arguing about who was the greatest.
I think that's something we can all relate to, right? We all have those moments where we get caught up in comparisons and vying for position. So what exactly were they bickering about?
They were on the road and they start arguing about who holds the highest rank among them. It's such a human moment, isn't it? Even those closest to Jesus weren't immune to these kinds of petty squabbles.
So how does Jesus handle this little power struggle among his followers? What does he do to redirect their thinking?
Well, he doesn't exactly scold them. Instead, he uses it as an opportunity to teach them a really profound lesson about true leadership. And the way he does it is so brilliant, so unexpected.
All right, I'm hooked. Let's dive into that in part two.
So you're probably wondering, like, how did Jesus actually address this whole argument about who's the greatest? Well, picture this. Jesus calls the disciples together. And then right in the middle of this debate about power and prestige, he places a child in their midst.
A child, really? What's the significance of that?
It's so brilliant when you think about it, because in that culture, children weren't seen the way they often are today. You know, they weren't these symbols of innocence or purity. They were like the lowest on the social ladder, weak dependent, no real status or power.
So by placing a child in the middle of this argument, Jesus is like turning their whole concept of greatness upside down. He's challenging their assumptions about what it means to be powerful and important.
Exactly. He goes on to say, whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. And it's such a powerful statement. It completely reframes the conversation. It's no longer about who's the most impressive, who is the most authority, who's going to have the best seat at the table in the kingdom. It's about humility. It's about service. It's about welcoming and caring for those who are often overlooked or marginalized.
It's like he's saying, if you want to be great in my kingdom, then follow the example of a child. Be humble, be receptive, be willing to serve others.
And Dr. Jennings points out that the phrase, in my name, is really important here. It's not just about welcoming any child. It's about welcoming those who are identified with Jesus, those who are his followers, regardless of their social standing or worldly importance.
So it's a call to radical hospitality, a call to see Christ in the most unexpected places.
Absolutely.
It makes you wonder who we might be overlooking or dismissing in our own lives.
It does. And then Dr. Jennings kind of shifts gears a bit and goes back to something we touched on earlier. Jesus reiterates his prediction that he will be handed over to men and killed, and that he will rise again after 3 days. Remember, this is the second time he's told them this.
Wait, so this isn't the first time he's brought this up?
Nope. He first mentioned it back in chapter 8, right after Peter's confession that Jesus is the Messiah. And you can tell from the disciples' reaction that they're still struggling to, like, comprehend what he's talking about.
Well, I can't say I blame them. It's a pretty mind-blowing concept, even for us today. You know, it goes against everything they thought they knew about the Messiah.
Exactly. Dr. Jennings points out that the disciples wouldn't have understood resurrection as something that could happen to a single person in the middle of history. You know, in their minds, resurrection was this future event, something that would happen to all the righteous at the end of time.
So, and as Jesus talks about rising on the third day, it just wouldn't have computed. It's like their brains couldn't process it. They were probably thinking, what is he even talking about?
And Mark tells us that they were afraid to ask Jesus what he meant. And I think you can really sense their confusion and anxiety in this passage.
It must have been so unsettling for them, you know, so disorienting. They're trying to reconcile their understanding of the scriptures with what Jesus is saying and doing.
Right. And as if that weren't enough to try and wrap their heads around. Dr. Jennings points out this really intriguing detail in Mark 9.31, where Jesus says that the Son of Man will be delivered into the hands of men. And he suggests that this specific phrasing actually hints at the divine orchestration of the Passion.
So it's not just a random act of violence. It's part of God's plan.
Precisely. It's this subtle foreshadowing of this idea that Jesus's death isn't just a tragedy. It's a sacrifice, this deliberate act of love and obedience to the Father. It's this incredible paradox. Jesus is both fully human, vulnerable to suffering and death, and yet he's also fully divine, willingly giving himself up for the sake of humanity.
I love how Dr. Jennings unpacks these subtle details that you might miss on a casual reading.
Mm-hmm.
And this section of Mark, as we've seen, it just keeps building and building. We go from the transfiguration to the demon-possessed boy to a lesson on humility to this cryptic prophecy about Jesus's death and resurrection, and it's still not over.
And what comes next is just as fascinating. We're moving into this section where Jesus continues to teach his disciples about true discipleship, about what it really means to follow him. And he uses some pretty bold imagery to get his point across.
Ooh, I'm intrigued. Sounds like we're in for quite a ride. Should we dive into that now, or do you think this is a good place to pause?
I think this is a great place to take a breath and just let everything we've covered so far sink in. You know, we've covered a lot of ground. The transfiguration, the challenging story of the boy with a demon, and Jesus's powerful lessons on true discipleship.
So much packed into just a few verses. All right, we'll pick up the rest of Dr. Jennings' lecture next time as we continue our deep dive into the Gospel of Mark. See you then. Welcome back. So last time we left off with Jesus reiterating this, like, really unsettling news to his disciples that he would be handed over, killed, and then rise again. And as Dr. Jennings pointed out, this wasn't something they were ready to hear, especially that part about rising again.
It just didn't fit into their understanding of the Messiah at all. But instead of kind of diving deeper into that mystery, Mark shifts to another teaching moment. And this time it's about what it looks like to be a part of Jesus's movement. You know, who is in, who's out, and what true allegiance really means.
Okay, so set the scene for us. Like, what happens that prompts this particular teaching?
Well, John, one of the disciples, tells Jesus about this guy who's out there driving out demons in Jesus's name. But here's the thing. This guy wasn't part of their group, and John seems kind of bothered by it, almost territorial, you know?
So it's like he's saying, hey, this guy is on our turf. He's not one of us. Shouldn't we, like, stop him?
Exactly. But Jesus's response is so insightful, and honestly, it's a much-needed message for the church. Even today, he says, do not stop him, for no one who does a mighty work in my name will be able soon afterward to speak evil of me, for the one who is not against us is for us.
There's such an openness in that statement, a sense of, look, if someone is doing good in my name, let them do it. Don't get so hung up on who's in and who's out.
Exactly. It's this call to unity and collaboration, a reminder that God's work isn't limited to, you know, a particular group or denomination. It's not about building walls and protecting our turf. Anyone who's acting in Jesus' name and advancing his kingdom is on the right side.
This is such a powerful message for the church today, especially in a time when there's so much division and infighting between denominations, even individual churches.
You're so right. It's a reminder that we should be way more focused on building bridges than building walls. And it highlights the importance of celebrating and affirming the work that God is doing through all who love and follow him.
And I think it ties back to that earlier lesson about the child, about humility. If we're truly focused on serving others, on embodying the heart of Christ, then who are we to judge how someone else is doing that?
I think you've hit on something really important there. It's about recognizing that God's Spirit is at work in ways that we may not always understand or agree with.
Okay, so we've seen Jesus emphasize humility and openness, but Dr. Jennings also talks about how this section of Mark includes some really stark teachings about the cost of discipleship. Like, Jesus uses some pretty graphic imagery to get his point across.
Oh, he does. He talks about cutting off a hand or a foot or plucking out an eye if they cause you to sin.
Those are some pretty intense images.
Talk about attention grabbing, but he's obviously not literally advocating for self-mutilation, right? What's the point he's trying to make with this kind of language?
Right. It's hyperbole. He's using this exaggerated language to emphasize the seriousness of sin and the need for radical action to avoid it. You know, he's saying that we should be willing to make these drastic changes in our lives to get rid of anything that leads us away from God, even if it's something that we're super attached to. It's about rooting out sin at its source, no matter how painful it might be.
Yeah, it's like ripping off a Band-Aid. It's going to hurt in the moment, but it's better than letting the wound fester.
Exactly. And he doesn't stop there. He goes on to talk about the fire that is not quenched and the worm that does not die, which are images drawn from the Old Testament that refer to eternal punishment. So there's this real sense of urgency and consequence here.
It's like he's saying, look, following me isn't a game. There are real stakes here. This is about your soul, your eternal destiny. It's pretty heavy stuff.
It is. And I think it challenges us to consider, like, what are we willing to sacrifice? What are we willing to give up for the sake of following Jesus? Are we willing to let go of the things that are holding us back, even if they're things that we cherish?
It's a question worth pondering, that's for sure. And then to kind of wrap up this incredibly dense and challenging section of Mark, but Dr. Jennings focuses on one final image that Jesus uses. He says, salt is good. But if the salt has lost its saltiness, how will you make it salty again? Have salt of yourselves and be at peace with one another. What do you make of that? What does it look like to have salt in ourselves?
That's such a great question. And Dr. Jennings suggests that salt here symbolizes purity and faithfulness. You know, just as salt preserves food from decay, our lives should be marked by this purity that sets us apart from the corruption of the world. It's about living out our faith authentically and consistently, not just in word, but in deed.
So it's not just about avoiding sin. It's about actively pursuing righteousness, about letting our faith permeate every aspect of our lives.
And notice how he connects this idea of having salt with being at peace with one another. It's another reminder of those themes we've been talking about throughout this whole section of Mark: humility, service, unity.
It's all connected. It's about rooting out sin, living with integrity, and fostering unity within the body of Christ. What a challenging and inspiring message.
And that's the beauty of Mark's gospel. You know, it's raw, it's honest, and it doesn't shy away from these difficult truths about what it means to follow Jesus.
We've covered a lot of ground today. We've journeyed from the mountaintop to the valley, from dazzling glory to stark warnings. What's one key takeaway you hope our listener walks away with from this deep dive into Mark 9?
I think the biggest takeaway for me is that discipleship is a journey, not a destination. It's messy, it's challenging, and it requires constant examination of our own hearts and motivations, but it's also incredibly rewarding. And it leads us to this deeper understanding of who Jesus is and what he calls us to be.
So well said. And to our listener, if you're feeling challenged, even a little overwhelmed by everything we've explored today, take heart. You're not alone. Keep wrestling with these ideas. Keep asking questions and keep seeking God's guidance. You might be surprised by what you discover along the way. Until next time.